To me, there's a bigger question, too, though, and this is what really infuriated me about the briefing, is they maintain, both in private and in public, that a vote by Congress in 2003 or 2002 to go after Saddam Hussein was a vote that allows them to still be in Iraq and do whatever they want, including killing a foreign general from Iran. And I don't think that's what Congress meant in 2002, nor do I think one generation can bind another generation. So my point in being for this war powers debate is that we really need to have a debate about whether we should still be in Iraq or in Afghanistan, and there needs to be authorization from Congress.
That was Senator Rand Paul on Meet the Press Sunday, talking about his support for limiting President Donald Trump's ability to commit further acts of war in the Middle East. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined per usual by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mengu Ward. Good morning, y'all.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Oscar nomination Monday.
Boy.
You sound unsure.
Thanks for bringing us down.
I think that's just the millennial end every sentence in a question thing. We're going to dive into lots of developments that have happened with regards to Iran since last we convened. But first, do you out there like libertarian podcasts? I'm guessing you do. So go check out our friends over at Lions of Liberty. We've got three different weekly programs on their singular podcasty feed. The first is the Monday flagship show, Lions of Liberty, featuring interviews with the likes of Ron Paul and Gene Epstein and Nick Gillespie. Wednesday, they have Electric Liberty Land, a comedic look at culture and current events. And then there's Felony Friday, a peek under the velveteen robes of the criminal justice system. Weesh. Don't at me, Catherine. Don't even do it. Go to lionsofliberty.com. Make sure to roar. That's very important. Or just head to your nearest podcast platform. You'll be glad you did. Okay. So a bunch of news since last we talked. Iran sent a volley of missiles in the general direction of U.S.-held territory in Iraq in retribution for the U.S. killing of senior Iranian military official Qasem Soleimani. These missiles did no real damage to Americans, but accidentally shot down a Ukrainian airliner, killing all 176 passengers aboard. Protests have erupted all over Iran, or are ongoing as we talk on this Monday, against the regime there. Police have used live fire to disperse the crowds. President Donald Trump has tweeted out all caps warning several times, do not kill your protesters. Speaking of the president, he spent the weekend accusing Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats of defending Soleimani and supporting the Iranian regime. This morning, he was retweeting out pictures of Chuck Schumer and Pelosi in festive Iranian garb. As teased at the top of the show, administration briefers did not satisfy the curiosity of several Republican members of Congress, including the Senate's Rand Paul and Mike Lee, especially, both of whom were expected to vote with Democrats as early as Tuesday on Tim Kaine's resolution calling to remove United States armed forces from hostilities against the Islamic Republic of Iran within 30 days, unless responding to an imminent threat. The House passed a similar such resolution last week with just a couple of Republicans, Thomas Massey and Matt Gaetz, however you pronounce his name, throwing in with the Democrats, as well as independent Justin Amash, who is calling Trump's latest claims of Soleimani allegedly targeting up to four embassies as, quote, totally made up. And finally, as you can read at Reason and probably already have this morning, reporting in the Washington Post, New York Times is suggesting that the president agreed to kill Soleimani as late as 7 months ago. So that's another long, damned windup, but war tends to make lots of news happen. Peter, I want to start with you. Given what we have learned since last we all discussed, does the killing of Qasem Soleimani seem more or less kind of legally authorized under the War Powers Act, according to your estimation?
I would say less. And I think the main reason why is that the Trump administration has not been able to maintain a consistent reason explanation for why they chose to attack Soleimani and why they chose to attack him exactly when they did. At first, they said that it was in response to an imminent threat, and they suggested that perhaps there was going to be an attack on an embassy or even several attacks. And then they started saying things like, well, you know, if you need a reason, look at what's happened in the last several days. Basically saying that it was a response to things that had already happened. An imminent threat is not something that has already happened. And then when pressed on this issue by both the press and by lawmakers who were seeking to understand why the strike had happened and why they hadn't been consulted in advance, as they are typically supposed to be, the Trump administration has apparently not been able to provide much, if any, evidence that there was an imminent threat, that there was really an attack. They've basically said, well, there was a bunch of kind of scattered information that made us think there might be an attack coming at some point. And without an imminent threat and without a clear justification and without a justification that is consistent over time and appears to be true and backed by evidence, then it's hard to think of a way in which this strike is fully legally justified.
Catherine, the president suggested over the weekend, I believe, that maybe we should expand NATO to include countries in the Middle East. And he said that he even came up with a pretty cool name of it, what he called NATO-me. So good idea.
Isn't
or great?
Isn't it NATO-me?
NATO-me? Like did I misemphasize? I'm sorry. NATO-me?
I think it's not a thing, so we can pronounce it however we want.
So good idea or great idea?
Right. So the idea that Donald Trump is the guy to scheme broadly about how to grow, expand, edit our multinational, multilateral institutions is probably not the best place to start. But you know, the whole concept of NATO in general has always felt to me just a teeny bit like we're trying to have World War One again. So I know it's not. I know I'm not a foreign policy expert, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, making more and more and more mutual defense alliances can lead to a peaceful world where people understand each other better, or like somebody's going to kill an archduke and everything's going to go wrong. I'm not really sure which. Peter's recounting of the cascade of explanations that the administration has been giving for the imminent threat and why we had to do the attack, the assassination, is starting to remind me of our saga here in the Reason DC office to get our elevator fixed, which culminated, I would say, the high point.
I believe we authorized getting the elevator fixed as long as seven months ago.
Yes, we did. And the culmination of the process was a time when an elevator repair person came, saw that we had placed a sign on the doors of the elevator saying that the elevator was broken, and said, well, that's your problem right there. The sign is keeping the elevator doors from working properly.
No, that's not true. That can't
100%
be true.
That is a true story. See, and that is also the story, as far as I can tell,
of
the justification.
That I am in support of preemptive war against the Reason DC office, and I think that I'm right in this.
We should probably just burn it to the ground.
First strike capability.
Things escalate.
I'm going to cut you off because that was too good.
Do
and
it.
Whatever you're going to say is not going to be as good.
Let it ride.
Nick, I saw a lot of commentary, especially after Mike Lee and Rand Paul came out like furious last week after their briefing, of people saying, oh, gosh, you know, I didn't really see that coming of, you know, Republicans opposing Donald Trump. And it's like, this is kind of the reason for Rand Paul and Mike Lee, isn't it? I mean, like, this is what has animated them from the moment that they've entered Congress. And to imagine that they wouldn't be doing this right now is just kind of misreading the kind of philosophy that they bring to the table. No.
Yeah, it was really encouraging and heartening to see them come out in such, you know, open and disgusted terms about the way that the administration was briefing them. There's nothing about the actions that we're taking in Iraq that are legal. I think we get lost if we start talking about this in terms of the War Powers Act, in terms of even authorization of use of military force, and the justifications that all of these little things kind of dictate. You know, as Rand Paul was saying, You know, and I would like to see him host this conversation in the Senate, much less in Congress more broadly, more forcefully of, you know, what we are doing is, or what Donald Trump represents is the absolute end game of, on the first hand, George Bush, and then on the second hand or the other hand, Barack Obama, the way that they conducted foreign policy. You have, you know, thesis, worst thesis, and then you have Donald Trump as the kind of awful synthesis. And this is where it goes to die. One of the reasons we weren't supposed to go into Iraq in the first place is that it's really hard to get out. We are now in Iraq and Syria. We're basically about to go into Iran. We're in Yemen. We're all over the place. And it's not, you know, absent a clear, you know, order from the country through Congress, et cetera, we're just going to be kind of trailing blood everywhere we go there for the foreseeable future.
It feels, Peter, to me like, and you have seen these maps, John Glaser from Cato has tweeted these things out, of just like a map of Iran, but the surrounding region and all the concentrations of U.S. military forces on various bases across it. It's pretty easy to look at that, consider the amount of firepower that the U.S. has, and you can imagine why Iran would be a little bit defensive or nervous or some such. But the trouble with this, and Rand Paul talks about this in the broader clip, which I recommend everyone go and take a look at, you have on the one hand the kind of Trump instinct to not want to get involved in nation building. He said explicitly in his comments about this attack, he doesn't want to do regime change in Iran. And yet by sending a net gain of troops out there, you're just increasing tripwires. I feel like there hasn't been enough discussion or acknowledgement that there is more, not fewer, red lines that are associated now under Trump than there had been before 10 days ago. I mean, he said specifically before he said anything else in the press conference the other day or in his announcement the other day, he said, Iran will not get a nuclear weapon on our watch. That's just basically a red line, is it not?
I think that's exactly what it is. And my worry is that it comes back to haunt President Trump, someone who does not like to be portrayed as weak, someone who does not like to be portrayed as refusing to counterpunch. And it's basically exactly what you said. Every one of these moves has been an escalation. And even if the retaliation from Iran was relatively minimal, was proportional and didn't kill any Americans and was the kind of thing where Trump could say, well, you did that, we did our thing, and let's call it quits for the moment. Adding troops, taking out an Iranian general, increasing hostilities in this way, or at least increasing tensions, means that there is still the risk, and perhaps even a greater risk, of war, of conflict down the road, especially when you combine it with these political red lines that Trump is drawing for himself and for the nation. And that's very dangerous. And so, I mean, again, I'm not a Middle Eastern foreign policy scholar. At the same time, a country like Iran has an incentive to wait out the United States and not to just sort of say, okay, we want to get into a big war right now. That would be dumb of them. If they wanted to get revenge, if they wanted to strike back in a way that was going to actually hurt the United States, the smart thing for them to do would be to wait, to use proxies, to build better weapons, to try and get a nuclear weapon and wait perhaps even years to use that. And this increases the likelihood, perhaps not a huge amount, but at least a little, this increases the likelihood that Iran will plot over the course of years to get back at the United States and its allies and result in a much larger, much deadlier conflict in the long run.
I think one of the things to think about from a U.S.-centered perspective, but is what is going on in Iran over the past 20 years? Because right prior to the invasion by the U.S. of Iraq in the early 2000s, there were massive, you know, super big protests throughout Iran, especially outside of Tehran, by students and younger people who were fed up with the Islamic Republic. And it is a regime which posits, you know, a theocracy and kind of fealty to, you know, non-materialist goals of Islam, etc., that has been increasingly revealed both to people outside, but especially inside Iran, as just, you know, total fakers. I mean, that they are you know, burrowing away money in Swiss bank accounts, et cetera. It's a corrupt regime that is not doing anything to allow people in Iran to flourish, particularly younger people, and it's one of the youngest countries on the planet, et cetera. And those protests stopped the minute that the U.S. invaded Iraq, because, you know, for obvious reasons, and it just becomes harder and harder to do that. Now we, you know, you flash forward 15, 20 years later almost, and we've taken out Iran's major regional enemy, a counterpower in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The protests are starting up again, and they started up in 2017, 2018. They've continued in late November. There were massive protests throughout Iran. They're continuing into January. I mean, just recently after the Ukrainian plane was shot down, there was a major unrest in Iran. There is a argument, you know, rather it remains to be seen whether or not the killing of Soleimani is a big, big mistake, because it forces people within Iran to be a little bit more patriotic and to, you know, close ranks over what they perceive as America coming in. Or is it a sign, because it's outside of Iran, that this actually, you know, is going to embolden protesters? And, you know, the libertarian dogma would say that it's always a bad thing to do this, that, or the other thing. It could be that that's the type of action that actually helps people become more emboldened to protest in Iran. But the major question, and this is something that American foreign policy has never done well, is to allow developments within a country to get on with their own dynamic, because it's clear that the Iranian regime is highly, highly unpopular among large sections of the population. There was just an Olympic gold medalist from 2016 defected from Iran, a woman. These are all promising things, and these are the types of internal dissensions that mark a regime that's in big trouble. And whatever the U.S. can do to help further that, the better. And unfortunately, we typically take that as a sign to start pushing. And Matt, as you were talking about building up red lines all over the place, this may be a point where we need to pull back a little bit and let Iran, you know, topple its own regime in the same way that we, you know, emboldened, by our brutish foreign policy under the Shah, we helped the Islamic Revolution actually come into being. And I this is not a discussion that anybody is having, which is, I think, really, really problematic, because we seem to have learned nothing in the past 20 years of absolute disastrous foreign policy adventure after one another.
Catherine, seeing Trump, of all people, you know, say that Democrats support Soleimani, and seeing this kind of revival of that type of rhetoric, am I too hopeful that that stuff falls flat on people's ears? It just feels so 2004 and three, and like, that doesn't work still, does it?
I don't know. I would have said that if it weren't for, we talked about this a little bit last week, the overwhelming reaction on the part of people, even people that I like and respect and think are smart people, to just go back to this very, very simple kind of Manichaean, well, Soleimani was evil, this was therefore good. And that type of conversation maybe never goes away. And so, you know, the enemy of the enemy is my friend, the friend of my enemy is my enemy, that everyone's enemies and friends. That's just how humans are. So yeah, I think you probably are too hopeful. I have been reading this morning a bit and trying to figure out why it is that it seems to me that there are always protests in Iran. Like, as far back as I can remember, there are protests in Iran that are about to result in big change always.
Protesting is the new brunch.
If only the U.S. can support or not support in exactly the right way, or sanction or not sanction, or murder or not murder the correct combination of people, either in public or in private. And I just can't quite square that constant hopefulness with the actual ongoing disaster.
Look, when you invade a country with which in recent memory you had a massive border war that, you know, inflicted millions of casualties on both sides, things change. And, you know, the U.S., I mean, this is the thing about U.S. foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, especially in Iraq. It's like, it's a big, big deal. I mean, we spent, you know, trillions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of troops to depose, occupy, and further screw up a region which is already screwed up. But I mean, this is also like saying in the Cold War, various parts of Eastern Europe were pushing back against communist regimes. They do, you know, it's unsuccessful. They protest until something changes. And, you know, that I think that's what you have to look forward to. Otherwise, you know, what do you do? And it's a better alternative than saying, let's go and invade a bunch of people and liberate them. Let's completely ignore what's going on in the rest of the world. We have soft power. We have diplomatic power. We have trade power. We have all sorts of things that we can use that are short of military intervention.
Peter, before we leave the topic, so we can count on probably Rand Paul and Mike Lee providing some sort of buffer in the Senate. There was a vote a couple of months back in which both houses of Congress passed or put on Donald Trump's desk bill regarding Yemen. He ended up vetoing it, but it was the first kind of exercise of congressional muscle memory of having any kind of a say into America's war-making ability there. Looking at the world of Mitt Romney's and Susan Collins's and other people like that, do you see any sense that there is a revived interest in going full Rand Paul Thomas Massey on this? Or do you sort of sense that it's just kind of the usual people retreat into whatever their party is doing, whether it's Democrats backing Barack Obama to do whatever the hell in Libya, which had a hell of a lot less imminent threat to America than Iran does now?
I don't see much movement towards reasserting congressional powers over war at all on the left or on the right, except in partisan terms. Democrats are going to do this because of Trump, but as soon as, President Warren or President Biden decides to launch an ill-advised, unauthorized strike, there's going to be a lot of hemming and hawing and, you know, justifications. And the reason I don't see it on the right at this moment, I think the actual indicator is not even so much how they're talking about the strike in Iran, but how they're talking about impeachment. The Republicans are either going to defend the president and just defend the president and basically be cleanly defending the president. And again, with some occasional exceptions like Rand Paul, Mike Lee, maybe. But for the most part, they're either going to defend the president and just defend whatever it is he does, or they're going to start turning on him in a real way. But until they start turning on him in a real way, which we will know when impeachment starts to look like something that Republicans are taking seriously and not just kind of doing the Lindsey Graham thing of saying, well, you know what my vote is, I'm not pretending to be an impartial juror, then I think that there's not going to be much movement to rein in the president when it comes to war powers either.
Peter just dropped impeachment, which could go to the Senate as early as tomorrow on Tuesday. It probably will take maybe a little bit longer. Nick, were you tickling yourself?
No,
what's
aren't we done with impeachment?
It's going to go to the Senate this week, most likely.
It's like The Godfather. There's another one. And then like 20 years later, there's another one that we all pretend didn't happen.
I think it's more like the...
Are we doing the third one now, though, maybe?
No, we're doing the... I don't know, actually.
There was like an impeachment before
It's actually like this is the third movie in the Matrix trilogy. So there was the first Matrix and then the second two they shot at the same time and released in the same year, 6 months apart. And so we are now on the third Matrix film, which is objectively the worst Matrix film, the third Matrix of impeachment. We're going to title this podcast.
Isn't, in fact, Suderman wrong? And isn't this really the Indiana Jones series?
The third Matrix movie is better when you compare it to the Wachowski team's Speed Racer.
The Wachowski siblings.
Wachowski, excuse me. Thank you. What do we call them now? The Wachowski siblings?
I think they're just sisters now, right?
Just the perplex, I think. Wachowski.
Perplex. Always use perplex when possible. Yeah.
The curious case of the Wachowski perplex.
In defense of the curious case.
We call them the Wachowskis.
Okay.
I think that that's it. That we've done impeachment, and we're safe to go on. Yeah,
We've briefly done trans politics, which is always good. It's solid. Move it right through. Keep going.
Dick, I feel like...
March as if we're heading to Baghdad, baby.
Great. There's actually breaking news in the Democratic race that I want to get to and get immediate
Amy Klobuchar has a spork comb now or something. What's the breaking news, Matt?
I'm going to tell you in a moment. But first, Nick, I'm going to tell you about fire. So, Mike was prevented from discussing marijuana legalization at his college. Naomi could not start an animal rights club. Kevin's school, irony alert, wouldn't let him hand out copies of the Constitution. Each of these students had their free speech rights violated. Each got help from FIRE. FIRE is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. It is one of our very favorite organizations in the world. I speak confidently for the group when I say that. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that defends the speech rights of all students and faculty at America's colleges and universities, regardless of politics. You can learn more about FIRE by texting FIRE to 52886 or by visiting website thefire.org. With the help of FIRE, Kevin, the Constitution kid aforementioned, took his case to court and won, vindicating the free speech rights of more than 150,000 students in the process. If you out there in listenerhoodville need help defending constitutional rights on campus, text FIRE to 52886 or visit thefire.org. This is what they do. They've been around for two decades. Most of us were at their 20th anniversary the other week, month in New York, which is great. They fight colleges and win. Text FIRE to 52886 or visit thefire.org. You'll be glad you did. Catherine, Cory Booker just dropped out. What? He just dropped out of the presidential race.
I'm sad. I'm sad about it. I know that, you know, in some ways, his run, I think, has been, well, I was going to say his run has been the most disastrous. Actually, Kamala Harris's run was the most disastrous in terms of taking a very promising political career and turning it into what might be more like a dead end. But Booker's tale was just one of, like, never catching on and slowly dying a pathetic death, which is a bummer because I think, as we talked about, his performance, particularly in the last debate where he was on the stage, where he said things that were perfectly freaking sane occasionally, like, hey, maybe growth and opportunity would be good for the poorest people in society. Just throwing it out there. Who typically was less on team, everything that everyone wants will be free forever, and more on team, we should occasionally look at budget numbers, also a welcome addition to the... Occasionally, again, yeah, not a fiscal conservative, let's not get crazy. He definitely did a little bit of toggling back and forth on education as somebody who had been pretty good on school choice and done some genuinely interesting experiments in Newark. And then maybe he's against it, maybe he's for it, maybe he's against it. But I, for the life of me, really don't understand why he didn't catch on as at least a viable sort of top second tier or even a first tier candidate, given his personal appeal and his impressive record and his, like, comically good kind of narrative of, like, he's, like, pulling people out of burning buildings and, you know, living in the projects.
But not in the, like, getting in front of the EMTs who are trying to do it faster and better kind of way.
And not in the douchey getting in front of the EMTs who are trying to do it faster way, which is, can we just take a minute and say, like, what was that? Blech. Yes, I mourn his departure, though I am not surprised by it. And I wish that politics was a thing right now that had a place for Cory Booker.
Why? Peter, you just made a very convincing case that he's a complete non-entity.
Disagree. I'm making the case that he's a relatively sane person who's willing to experiment with ideas of personal choice and economic freedom in actual policy implementation.
But Peter, to that, could this be a case of the center holding? And let me try to explain what I mean by that, which is to say, now that Booker's gone, following in the footsteps of Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Beto O'Rourke, all of whom, and Julian Castro, too, all of whom at some point had centristy ideas and stuff, all of whom then ran to the wokest part of the spectrum and got drubbed. Meanwhile, Amy Klobuchar has from the beginning said, you know, has tried to claim a kind of centrist territory and been bulwark against Sandersism and Warrenism in ways that those five weren't, and they all got drubbed. So maybe given that Michael Bloomberg is polling at 5%, kind of unapologetically, you know, I'm Michael Bloomberg, centrist guy, maybe they shouldn't have run to the wokest part of the spectrum.
I think there's something to that theory. This Democratic primary is a race between the very, you know, sort of the strong left progressive faction represented most prominently by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and a more moderate centrist faction of which Joe Biden is leading, but has Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and like late Cory Booker, like the last two or three months of Cory Booker. And Cory Booker's changing message, the fact that he changed his persona somewhat throughout the year from what we had kind of understood him to be, I think wasn't great. But this was going to be a hard year for him to stand out as a giant field. Joe Biden just kind of ate up the whole center lane, with Pete Buttigieg being the only one who has really mounted a challenge to the moderate centrist, you know, sort of lane in this field. I would say, though, that when I say moderate and when I say centrist, it's just worth remembering how much the Democratic center has moved. And you can look, just to take one figure, you can look at the proposed tax hikes that Joe Biden's campaign has put out and that Pete Buttigieg's campaign has put out. These guys are the centrist campaigns, the centrist candidates in this race. And Joe Biden is proposing something like two or three times what Hillary Clinton proposed in terms of tax hikes. And Pete Buttigieg is proposing something like five or six times. You know, we're talking trillions and trillions of dollars of tax hikes. And that's, you know, that's the pragmatic small ball, you know, we're not going to do too much center in the Democratic campaign, in the Democratic field right now. And I think that in and of itself is pretty telling as to where the race, where the field has moved. And then the fact that you have Sanders and Warren competing so well, you know, they're neck and neck at the top of the polls in Iowa, and it is possible that either of them could win. It is even possible, I think, at this point, something that I would not have said 3 months ago, I think it is now possible that Bernie Sanders could end up with a Democratic primary nomination, and that is pretty telling.
Nick, to that, there's been a spate of recent polls. Sanders is kind of surging. You see the requisite, you know, former Obama administration person saying, well, Bernie would be a disaster, you shouldn't do that. You have kind of behind the scenes elbows being thrown by Sanders supporters at Elizabeth Warren. She's a neo-lib sellout, you know, the billionaires like her, this kind of thing. I'm reading all of this, and I went back and read our Democratic National Convention coverage from 2016 and was reminded of just kind of like how immovable of a force the Bernie bros were there. That's just a series of protests. It was much more of a rollicking convention on the Democratic side than it was on the Republican side, to the surprise of a lot of people, I think, going into both of those events, considering the disruptive factor of Donald Trump. But there was booing of various speakers. There was walkouts. There was duct tape on people's mouths. It feels to me, or I'm posing this as a possible question there, Nick, is that like it's as if there's an itch that can't possibly be scratched unless Bernie Sanders is the candidate among his supporters. It's not just that they won't move. They hate everything else with such ferocity. And it just kind of, are they just like blundering towards Jeremy Corbynism here? Like, we got to go full Corbynista or Sandersista here. And that is the only way that we can go forward.
Yeah. But I don't think that they have the numbers within the Democratic Party. Was it last week that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted out or talked about how insane it is that she's in a party with somebody like Joe Biden, and that, you know, in any other sane country, you know, in Venezuela, maybe she would be in a very different party than Joe Biden. That's, you know, there is a coming settlement of tendencies within the Democratic Party. It's easy to look at the Republican Party and the kind of crack up because of Trump and the way that he split a lot of sentiments within the Republican Party. But it's the Democratic Party that is going through more growing pains. And I think Peter is absolutely right to talk about when we're talking about centrists like Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg in the Democratic Party, they are unrecognizably to the left of where, you know, Hillary Clinton or the modal Democrat was simply in 2016, much less, you know, 2012 or 2000 or anything like that. And I think we, you know, that's something that needs to be factored in. And what we're looking at, to the extent that if somebody like Warren or Sanders wins both Iowa and New Hampshire, if the same person wins both of them and gets the type of bump that those kinds of victories typically do, I think you will see a race to a presidential election, a general election, where the winning candidate, even without a strong third party candidate, is going to be in the low 40s. Because, you know, Trump clearly is not going to get more than maybe 40, 45, 48% of the general election vote, you know, if he's lucky, but neither will a Warren or a Sanders. I mean, they're just incapable. Their agenda is genuinely unpopular among people because it is so far to the left.
To bring this back to the first topic just a little bit, I do think that Trump striking the Soleimani strike against Iran plays into Bernie Sanders' hands, because Bernie Sanders is, whatever else you might say about him, he is an authentic anti-war populist going back decades. And that gives him an advantage in a political climate that is populist, that is more anti-war or skeptical of you know, long-term foreign entanglements in any case, and that is sort of has a kind of burn it all down, you know, throw the bums out, outsider politics kind of vibe. That is the kind of politics that Bernie Sanders has practiced effectively and for decades, and he is running on that once again. And I think that's part of the explanation for why he has such diehard supporters. I always assumed that that was going to give him a ceiling, that he was going to have this as well as a floor, that he was going to have this small group of hardcore supporters, but would struggle to expand beyond that. But the other thing about him is that he's also, as a senator, been a reasonably effective kind of legislative tactician. And if you think back to the 2018 midterm, what did Democrats run on? They basically ran on pre-existing conditions in Obamacare. It was a sort of kitchen table, economics, policy focused race for, you know, for the Democrats. And that was effective for them. And in some ways, Bernie Sanders is running on this big political revolution and these, you know, sort of high-minded, you know, we're going to do democratic socialism, you know, totally change the way we do politics here in America. But he's also just running on some really, I don't quite want to call them practical, but let's call them, you know, close to home issues for a lot of people, healthcare and education, that sort of thing. And he's just saying that politics is about policy change and it's about making your individual life better. And that is a message that works.
But it doesn't work for many people, particularly. And I agree with you that he is the anti-war candidate, you know, which isn't to say that other people aren't anti-war, but he has been articulating that explicitly for a long time. I think where Trump battens that or pushes against that with another type of populism is that Trump is smart to say he doesn't want war, he doesn't want regime change, he's going after specific bad guys. And I think a lot of right-wing or right-leaning populists will kind of like, they kind of like that for the same reason they like Trump, that he takes out an Iranian general. He's not, you know, he's not killing people at wedding parties, and much less like launching troops into, you know, into invading someplace. So I think that's kind of a moot, you know, that washes out on the populism side. But Sanders was more popular, you know, a year ago. He struggles to get above 20% or much, you know, consistently above 20% and staying there in national polls, because the minute he starts talking about Medicare for all and free college for all and free everything for all, people start to wonder how the hell they're going to pay for this. And, you know, things can get worse. So I mean, this is, for me, what's interesting with the rise of somebody like Sanders is, does he end up pulling people out of the Democratic Party? Because he's still technically an independent, too. And if there are people like AOC and her squad, I don't think they have many troops or even many followers outside of Twitter, but do they become a permanent group that actually moves almost out of the Democratic Party, or does? That, to me, is kind of the issue, because it's clear mainstream Democratic politics isn't working for people. Mainstream Republican politics isn't working for people. But the Republicans have cohered around Trump in a way the Democrats seem genuinely split.
I obviously think that the Bernie Sanders agenda is fantasy land. However, it is notable that Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren have seen their campaigns dragged down by trying to explain how they would pay for Medicare for All or implement it or whatever. And Bernie Sanders, by eliding the question and just sort of saying, we're going to do a revolution, has managed to float above a lot of that and miss a lot of the kind of it hasn't been a burden on his campaign the same way that it certainly, I think, has been on Elizabeth Warren and on Kamala Harris's campaign.
Do you think, though, Peter, do you think like when he's on a debate stage with Donald Trump and Trump says, how are you going to pay for that? And then he has to actually explain it, because you're right. I mean, he just basically, you know, he doesn't really explain how he pays for stuff. You know,
he's going to have to explain it any more than he already has. I mean, Donald Trump is not going to be in a position to push back on the fiscal unsoundness of his hand wavy pay fors.
No, but Trump says, I mean, he just tweeted out, I made pre-existing conditions safe. We have record economic growth. We have, you know, great tax policy. We're covering it. We're buying shiny, you know, Nobody seems to be, and certainly nobody from the Democratic side is going to be like, you know, Trump's real problem is that he is spending a lot of money we don't have.
They're
going to do exactly the same thing.
I just want to underline the phrase hand wavy pay fors as really like a top five moment for me on
hand wavy pay fors. I stand by it.
On this podcast. It's great. Catherine, part of Bernie's, you know, when people ask Bernie, like, can you be elected? He's like, well, you know, if we have a revolution, then that's how I get elected. But that depends entirely on getting young people to vote. Are you optimistic that there's going to be a revolution of young people voting here?
I definitely wouldn't use the word optimistic to describe that thing. Yeah, I mean, I, as I've said many times, have decided not to make any more political predictions about who might win the presidency, especially not on the grounds of like, this person seems too crazy. Surely the American public will recognize that, because I did that wrong last time. And I've already sort of done it wrong this time in saying like, OK, but really, it's not going to be Bernie. And at least for a hot minute right now, looks like it could be Bernie. I don't know. I can't make predictions. I'm terrible at them, apparently, just like the rest of the political press corps. So that out of the way, I do, you know, the thing that this reminds me of the most is Ron Paul, except more and bigger, like a lot more. But it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. It's an old grandpa speaking truth, not worrying about the details, anti-war. The Youngs are, you know, he's circumvented, or he's like too old to be okay boomered, right? He's outside of that intergenerational hatred, and therefore has a sort of paradoxical appeal even in his elderly confusedness. And it just so happens that in this case, the thing in addition to being anti-war isn't auditing the Fed or ending the Fed, it's Medicare for All.
And free college.
It's the same. And, you know, we have seen in the libertarian movement lasting effects of the not quite all the way there Ron Paul revolution. And I think the Democratic Party, similarly, will see lasting effects of the probably not quite all the way there Bernie Sanders revolution. But maybe it'll get all the way there and then he'll be our president. And I don't know anything in the end.
Peter, Nick referenced this before, but I wanted to challenge you to take 60 seconds or less to respond with a fact check of the president's tweet. I will read that tweet to you now. Minnie, it's impossible to do.
You know, Kennedy, you can do it.
You ever do, like, you guys have all been on Kennedy's show, like when she reads the Trump tweet, she can't. She can't keep the straight face. It's just impossible. Minnie Mike Bloomberg is spending a lot of money on false advertising capitalized. I was the person who saved pre-existing conditions capitalized in your healthcare capitalized. You have it now, while at the same time winning the fight to rid you of the expensive, unfair, and very unpopular individual mandate capitalized extra space. 60 seconds, fact check.
Trump, the Republican Congress passed a bill that zeroed out the individual mandate in 2017. Trump signed that bill, so he can take credit for making the individual mandate moot. However, if he wants to take credit for the pre-existing conditions regulations the laws that are on the books that most people think of as the protections for people with pre-existing conditions. And if you gave me another 2 or 3 minutes, I could explain why they are in many ways not protections. But let's say, that's what people are talking about. The Republican Congress tried to take those down, and the Trump administration is refusing to defend them in court in response to a suit by a bunch of Republican AGs right now. It is just false to say that Trump is supporting those laws. However, the Trump administration has taken a bunch of small ball actions through HHS that make it easier for people to get cheaper plans, however, that offer fewer benefits. And that is a good thing overall.
Well done. Thank you.
Matt, you asked about the youth vote.
Yes.
And
the Utes.
There's a couple of things to think about. Between 2014 to 2018, two midterm elections, 18 to 29 year old vote, the voter turnout went from a 20% rate to about a 36% rate, which is a massive increase. If young people come out in those numbers, that probably helps Sanders a bit. It's not clear that that will, because the 2018 midterms were so much more participated in by all people than a typical midterm election. But it's not clear that any of that holds in a presidential year. What I was going to say is that in the Democratic debate that is, what, tomorrow night or right?
Tuesday night, Des Moines.
I think one of the questions that remains for somebody like Joe Biden, who is not doing well in Iowa or New Hampshire and is already minimizing expectations there in a bid to, he's probably going to pick up, or he's expecting to win big in South Carolina and Super Tuesday, which, you know, shortly after the South Carolina primary, is that if he can make a convincing case on foreign policy grounds that Trump doesn't know what he's doing, and that, in fact, Joe Biden, who has a long history as a hawk but has been recrafting himself to say within the Obama administration, he was more of a dove or a non-interventionist, I think that could blunt certain aspects of Sanders' appeal, if not in Iowa and New Hampshire in the general election. And I think we are, you know, to go to Catherine's point, this is going to be, a dueling grandpa election, because at this point, it's going to be either Sanders, Biden, and Warren on one side and Trump on the other. And it's going to be like Thanksgiving dinner with your least favorite part of the family for 8 months, which is what we have to look forward to.
One thing I'll just add to that in previous conversation is that it's kind of interesting to watch areas of the anti-interventionist or intervention skeptic right pretty pissed off. Tucker Carlson right now is getting record audiences by kind of trashing Trump's Iran policies, although he pins it on his advisors surrounding him as much as anything else. The American Conservative, the kind of the Pat Buchanan founded publication, is kind of hopping mad. The founding editor there, Scott McConnell, wrote a piece saying that he regrets now voting for Trump and that Hillary Clinton would have been better, which is pretty shocking to hear coming out of his mouth. We will see, just like we did, when National Review had its Against Trump issue in 2016. Whether there's actually any armies of voters associated with these intellectuals who are temporarily.
The answer is no, right? I mean, we know that. Who cares? Scott McConnell regrets voting for Trump?
For me, the question is more to Peter's point, which is one that we've stressed a lot at Reason over the years, that there is a gap between the interventionism of Washington and what voters like. I think you're right, Nick, to say that voters do like that kind of Jacksonian, I'll sock you in the jaw if you cross my path on one degree. But on another, they are very, very weary of wars in general. So I think we don't know how that plays out
I was thinking about this in the context I was reading.
You do see public opinion polls that show that more people now believe that Trump's strike has made it more likely that we will end up in a war with Iran. So people worried about that.
Right.
But, Nick, finish,
but what
finish
I'm
point.
Saying, what I was reading about Mike Mansfield, who was the longest serving Senate majority leader, and he was there through the, all of LBJ's presidency. And, before that, actually, he took over after LBJ left to be vice president. But in the 60s, in the Democratic Party, which had, massive majorities. You know, they ran the government. There was a huge split between people like Mansfield, who was very forward on civil rights and on the Great Society programs, but then was very anti-Vietnam. I mean, extremely hostile to Vietnam. And so you can see within a party a split between the domestic agenda and the foreign policy, you know, agendas of things. Within the Republican Party, I mean, there are people who are rightly pissed, and I wish that they would become full-fledged libertarians rather than pretending to be conservatives about all of this stuff. But the fact of the matter is that foreign policy plays a much smaller role in the way people think about voting now. There is no draft. We're not in a Vietnam type situation. And even during the hottest moments in Iraq and in Afghanistan, it was clear that that wasn't enough to win the presidency, you know, just revulsion at that, because somebody like John Kerry would have been able to pull it off. And, you know, so I think we need to, you know, be, or not we need to be realistic, but it's just that foreign policy is never, unless we're talking about something like World War II or Vietnam, where there's a full-fledged mobilization, it's just not what moves voters in large numbers. And that's not going to be the case.
I want to caveat that a little bit. In 2000, George W. Bush ran on nation building at home, and I mean, obviously it was an unusual election in some ways, but won. And in 2008, Obama ran in large part on McCain would continue George W. Bush's foreign policy mistakes. And Obama was viewed as the anti-war candidate. And that was
the hope and change.
Nation building at home. And Republicans launched us into a screwed up war in the Middle East and are trying to continue it with McCain were messages that resonated with the American people and that won presidencies.
It would be impossible at this point to kind of disentangle Gore's and Bush's campaign promises, which was an absolute dead heat. Both of them had foreign policies that looked pretty similar at the time. Both of them had tax cuts that looked pretty similar at the time. And Gore actually promised to cut taxes a little bit less and spend a little bit less. I'm just saying, I don't think we're going to see foreign policy be the deciding factor in this election because Trump is not promising to do anything large scale. He is not saying we're going to do regime. I mean, this is why he's smart. If we take his utterances as intentional rather than as kind of hilarious, you know, by distancing himself from regime change, I think he's placating large numbers of populace who might otherwise be like, you know what, I'm going for Bernie Sanders because he's going to be the anti-war candidate.
Let's go to our end of show cultural consumption. As Peter highlighted at the top, the Academy Award nominations came out today. So Peter, maybe I'll just throw it to you to start what you've been consuming with the idea that maybe you'll somehow tie this into the nominations from this morning. Go!
The nominations are going to be controversial because Joker, which, as I think I've said on this podcast, I did not love, respected at the craft level, but thought it was a pretty awful movie with, you know, no moral center and just an awful lot of sort of empty callbacks to Martin Scorsese that didn't really add up to much, ended up being the film with the most nominations. That's going to be quite controversial, especially given some of the way the rest of it, some of the films that were shut out, in particular Uncut Gems, is the one that stood out to me as notably shut out because it was my favorite film of the year. I have not been feeling super great, and so I spent this weekend watching The Mandalorian. I will be the second person on this podcast after Robbie, who also spent a sick weekend watching The Mandalorian. And I gotta say, as folks know, I was not a huge fan of Rise of Skywalker. In fact, I really kind of hated it. I didn't like much of anything in that movie. And The Mandalorian isn't perfect, but it fulfills a lot of the kind of promise of expanding the Star Wars universe that the movies, the last trilogy, have not. And it is it's a more intimate story, less epic, a little bit of a kind of a side quest from a character who we haven't met before that doesn't involve, you know, these kind of galactic stakes that they have tried to insert into the movies recently, and doesn't just repeat beats that we have seen before, even though it feels in some ways familiar and uses a lot of elements that will certainly that fans of the franchise will recognize. So for folks who are thinking about whether or not it is worth signing up for Disney Plus subscription or watching The Mandalorian, spending your 8 hours on it, less than 8 hours, actually. One of the good things about this show is every single episode is less than 50 minutes, and quite a few of them are less than 40. So I would definitely recommend it to people who like Star Wars and wish it were better.
I love the recommendation of a show because it's short.
That's a real recommendation.
I'm a big fan of novellas for that reason. Yeah.
Too many prestige TV shows either have too many episodes or episodes are too long. And 8 episodes, none of which are overlong, is just about right. It's a good weekend's worth of television.
Also, add that if you're on Verizon wireless, and I believe otherwise, you can get a free year of Disney Plus, and a bunch of other a bunch of systems are giving it away for free, at least the first year.
Yeah.
But you have to have a smarter TV than I have, as my daughter has reminded me.
If you have an Apple TV or a Chromecast or any of these little devices that cost about $10.
Matt,
I guess a Chromecast is now $30. But
Matt's TV is still deeper than it is wide. So he's in the cathode ray.
It's an RCA, Nick.
Made in Camden, I hope.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
In anticipation of Curb Your Enthusiasm's 10th season, which will premiere next week, next Sunday on HBO, I was catching up on some of old episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm, particularly the season, and I'm forgetting, I think it was 5 or 6, when the Seinfeld reunion was the overarching plot thread for the season. And Curb Your Enthusiasm is a good show. And I'm looking forward to see where it ends up. It's like Trump, who it somehow seems that in a weird way, even though Larry David, the creator, plays Bernie Sanders on Saturday Night Live, he's really very much of a Trumpian figure. The show is very erratic. Sometimes it's great, and other times it's kind of puzzling in how shitty it is. But season 10 should be a delight. So I was catching up on that, and I recommend the season that has the Seinfeld reunion show in it.
Catherine.
I have been listening to the podcast You're Wrong About, which is like they just built a podcast name to tempt me to listen to it, and it worked. And it's just what it sounds like. It's a sort of revisiting of things you think you know to tell you the story behind. It's quite similar, I would say, to the super popular Slate podcasts that have been discussed on our podcast before. That's like, hey, you thought you knew about Monica Lewinsky? Wrong. You thought you knew about Watergate? Wrong. And this is that same vibe as Slate Slow Burn. So I recommend it. And the most recent one, or at least the most recent one I listened to, was about the DC sniper, which as someone who was in DC during that period, but I think it's sort of a vaguely forgotten episode for most people. I thought it was a very good episode. It tackled, among other things, I actually remember being told, like, when you get gas or otherwise in like a exposed area, you should walk in zigzags so that you won't get sniped. Like, that was just a thing that they were saying on the local news at the time. And I remember like kind of hearing that and being like, yeah, makes sense. And in retrospect, that's insane. That's crazy that like the entire DC metro area was walking in zigzags. It's a similar kind of crazy to school shooter drills and other things that have subsequently emerged as a response to fears about being shot or attacked. So
an erratic zigzag movement pattern with some hopping is actually a pretty good way to avoid snipers in online video games.
Cool.
This will either land or not, but all I got to say to that is Serpentine. Nick, are you with me? No, he remembers. He remembers.
I was going to say that, you know, suddenly New Jersey looked pretty good during the DC sniper for its bizarre rule of forcing minimum wage workers to pump your gas for you.
Yeah, New Jersey and Oregon. So what I consumed over the weekend was a bunch of songs by and articles about the band Rush, because the drummer and lyricist of Rush, Neil Peart, I have discovered his name is pronounced, although I don't believe it. So I'm going to...
Peart.
Part of my reading is like, actually, it's Peart. So I'm going to call it Peart because, I mean, come on, who are we? But anyways, the probably most, the band that's the answer to the Jeopardy question, like what is the most libertarian band of all time? It's pretty much Rush. I mean, like an album called Anthem, whole Randian anthems throughout, songs like I Will Choose Free Will. I've never been a big Rush fan. Neil Peart died over the weekend. This is why this happened. I've never been a huge Rush fan aside from just, you know, absorbing their songs on classic rock stations growing up. And it's an actual case where reading these really actually interesting and good bits, and especially the a piece in Rolling Stone talking about Peart's drumming style, and which is like super math rocky and technically perfect, and it's always put me off because of that. It's not the way I like to approach listening to rock music, but made the argument that style somehow set him free in an interesting way. It's just been actually kind of moving to listen to some of these songs and seeing this as a great kind of heroic expression of the weird art among these bizarre Canadian seekers of truth and light by their own light. It's just, you would not ever say that this is not your blueprint for any kind of successful career. And yet they turned it into a remarkably successful career with some pretty damn good riffs and just bizarre four syllable lyrics. I highly recommend, just if you have a streaming device, to shuffle the songs by, because you'll get a lot of interesting weirdo music, and it's worth, you know, I feel like rock is a dead or dying genre, so it's more of an obituary medium these days. And so when someone dies, it's time to sit there and listen and appreciate their work. So I've been appreciating the work of Neil Peart, who, again, I've not been a huge fan of over the years, but who's been mentioned several times in the pages of Reason over the decades, including by Matt Kibbe 3 or 4 years ago, talking about that was his entree into libertarianism. But pour a 40 out for Neil Peart, and that's all the alcoholism that we have time for. Nick, you're a Peart fan, Rush fan?
You know, I enjoy them on occasion, but didn't Neil Peart or Neil Peart disown his Ayn Rand phase?
Doherty wrote about, Brian Doherty wrote about this 3 or 4 years ago. He distanced himself from Ayn Rand, and then also slammed Rand Paul as a racist 4 or 5 years ago, or which I wrote about at the time. Yeah, he sort of arm's lengthed it, his youthful Randianism. And it's inaccurate listening to all these songs to say that every one of these songs was about this stuff. Right. It wasn't.
Some of them were just about living in the limelight.
I think most of them were just about weird time signatures.
I tried so hard, many. You guys, to like Rush. Like, I really tried. I was like, this is it. I'm going to find a band I like. And then it was like, nope, apparently I'm never going to find a band I like. Oh, well.
Isn't it a relief not to, like, not to have to endorse things because they fit an ideology that you prefer or not? Because, like, there was a period
this
where...
This was a primary thing that drove me away from, like, standard orthodox objectivism, is I was like, oh, really? We absolutely 100% have to like Rachmaninoff? I don't know. I mean, I like Frank Lloyd Wright and all, but then it starts to get a little complicated when it's like Marilyn Monroe is good, but we don't really understand why. And yeah, Rush maybe was what finally broke
I spent a youthful errant period wanting to really like folk music, like of the more classic folk revival of the late 50s and early 60s. And I tried as hard as I could to like Phil Oakes, and I just couldn't. You give it up, but it's also, the flip is true. You know, I'm not a Christian, I'm not a born again Christian, but I think Dylan's Slow Train Coming is like a phenomenal album, almost to the extent that it is completely opposite of my belief in, you know, theology or the afterlife, or, you know, sheiks in Amsterdam and Paris, laughing at us. It's all good.
I got a copy of Blood on the Tracks on vinyl for the first time last week, and oh my goodness.
Oh, that's a great
record.
It's
a completely different experience, and I finally got it. Like, I've been listening to that record for 5 years, trying to figure out, really, what do people love about this record? And now I understand, because I heard it on vinyl the right way.
Part of it is that having to flip the album over is a huge thing when you start to think about the sequence of tracks, I think.
I will close with this bit of Bob Dylan that I consumed for the first time at about 1:30 in the morning last night at Michael Moynihan's house, which is, he went on Letterman with some bizarre new wave punk band that he like recruited through his son in L.A. And played Joker Man as a punk song like in 1983. It is the most bizarre thing you'll ever see. Stop what you're doing. Go subscribe to all of our podcasts. Listen to Nick on Wednesday. Yes. But like, stop what you're doing and go find this. It defies every expectation of that song of Dylan. It's just totally bizarre and totally great. And that's all the time we have here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank you for listening and catch you next week.